The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
There are a bazillion dragonflies up here and not a whole lot of mosquitoes, so that's pretty good if you ask me.
Hi, I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. And to answer a listener question right now, we've got producer Taylor Quimby. He is currently standing by at an elevation of 1,413 feet in Epsom, New Hampshire. Taylor, how's it looking up there?
It is beautiful. The sun is out. There's a nice little breeze, and it's a great view.
So what's the question you're there to answer?
This question sent in by an anonymous listener is, how did Fort Mountain in Epsom get its name? Now, to answer, I'm going to read you a selection from Historical Sketch of Epsom, New Hampshire, which was compiled by Luella Marden Bunker for the town's 200th anniversary in 1927. It says, Jonathan Curtis, in his early history of Epsom, said that it probably was called Fort Mountain because of an eminence near the top resembling a fort.
So, did you find an eminence?
There is a giant chunk of rock that kind of looks like a huge loaf of bread, and I'm thinking maybe that was it.
New Hampshire is known for its dozens of majestic 4,000-footers, and of course for Mount Washington, home to the world's worst weather and perhaps our state's most ubiquitous bumper sticker. You know the one I'm talking about. As impressive as those peaks may be, there are dozens upon dozens of beautiful hikes and vistas that don't meet your average peak bagger's height requirement. So today on the show, we're celebrating shorter hikes, modest mountains, and climbers who aren't necessarily trying to set any records, like Dick Stewart.
And I don't do the real big ones anymore, because the knees start to act up.
Dick's wife grew up summering in Sandwich, New Hampshire, and the couple moved here full-time after retiring 4 years ago.
I am 74. Tell me I don't look it.
You do not look it. There are loads of hiking groups in New Hampshire for women, for families with young kids, for birders. A quick search on Facebook will turn up one or more that fits your style. And among them, perhaps the most easygoing group of alpinists out there, the Over the Hill Hikers Club.
Is there any kind of fitness test that people have to pass in order to be in the Over the Hill Club?
Just be able to hike your own hike and return on feet. that's the best advice.
That's Tracy Ripke. I met up with her and a bunch of hikers early on a Thursday morning at the town library in Sandwich. Then we piled in and carpooled up to the Guinea Pond Trailhead, just off the bumpy Sandwich Notch Road.
Where we hike, this is a bad part of the road, where we hike.
For the record, I do not consider myself over the hill yet, but like the pun of its title, this hiking club does not take itself too seriously. There are no dues or cabinet positions or even leaders among the 100-plus people currently on its mailing list. Tracy, however, did serve in the military for decades. And when we arrive at the trailhead, she's clearly comfortable taking charge.
Today's route is an out and back, so you can choose your pace and your distance however you're comfortable. But please enjoy and let's get moving.
It's about 2.5 miles up two trails to reach Black Mountain Pond and another 2.5 back. About 18 over the hillers are packed up and ready to go. I grab a bottle of water and start up the woody path with 81-year-old Milan McNall.
I am not a conqueror of mountains. I like the process, not the, I'm not a destination hiker.
Just up the way is Henry Metzger. He used to be a marathoner and has hiked all of New Hampshire's 4,000 footers. But now at a spry 85 years old, Henry picks hikes for pleasure, not endurance.
So you were never a peak bagger kind of guy, as they call
it. I did one round, and that was enough. Then I wanted to. There are some 4,000 footers that where you don't have a view at all because it's overgrown or whatever. And I had no interest in just doing it over and over again. But there's some people who they have the feeling it keeps them young or younger.
What do you think?
Well, it does. I think there's no question about it.
A About 10 years ago, the Over the Hill hikers split into three separate groups based on pace and level of difficulty. Today, I'm walking with the B group, those unafraid of a good hike, but who tend to stay off the more formidable presidentials. They've got a list they call 52 with a View, mountains like the Moats, Welch and Dickey, Monadnock and more. An alternative to the 48 4,000 footers that peak baggers itch for.
I grew up with mountains in the Adirondacks, where it was my father who would take us on trips. My mother did not care for it very much.
After the hike, I spoke with Sue Spears. She is 88 years old.
And then I married into the White Mountains. So for what did we do for our honeymoon? We went to Mount Katahdin.
The Over the Hill Hikers Club got its start way back in 1979. Sue joined about 10 years later after her husband and hiking partner broke his ankle in a car accident.
But some friends down the road said, hey, come with us, the Over the Hill Hikers.
Back then, the group was kind of caught up in peak bagging. They'd throw parties for members who managed to climb all of the state's 4,000 footers. They even had a club song set to the tune of Oh My Darlin' Clementine.
Crazy hikers, every Tuesday they do climb, knocking off 4,000 footers, marching always in a line.
Any member who bagged all 48 would be honored with their own verse.
Do you have a verse, Sue?
I have a verse, unfortunately, since, among other things, I taught school for a lot of years, and among other subjects, I taught Latin. So that my verse was in Latin, and I don't know it by heart.
The group was founded by Sandwich resident Dot LaPointe. But hikers like Sue say it was a woman named Lib McGregor Bates that turned the Over the Hill Hikers into an institution.
She was really the den mother who organized the group. And for, I think, close to 15 years, she was the one who would help people make out the schedule, who would type it all up, mail it all out. And she was the real spirit of the group.
Lib died peacefully in 2011 at her home in Center Sandwich. It was a bit of a small-town coincidence that her home would later be purchased by none other than Tracy Ripke, who, in addition to inheriting a home, has since picked up Lib's mantle as den mother of the Over the Hill Hikers.
Well, I want to make sure everybody's doing well. I want to make sure everyone has, you know, their water, their food, that they're feeling good, and just enjoying the time.
Is that the pond?
That's Guinea Pond.
It's an 80-degree summer day, but shady on the trail, and I am certainly enjoying my time away from the studio, even as we're forced to navigate wide patches of ankle-deep mud.
Going through a little bit of a monkey spot.
My bigger challenge is that the hikers have drifted into factions, so I have to pick up the pace to catch up with some of the speedier group members.
All right, I'm going to go catch up with some other hikers.
Thank you.
Eventually, the trail splits, and I catch up with Carl McNall and Jean Knox. Jean and her husband Dick moved to Sandwich after living 34 years in Boston.
And I love Boston, but if you move to Boston, that's fine, but nobody gets excited because everybody moves to Boston for jobs and for, you know, for 100 different reasons. When you decide to up and move your entire life to a place like Sandwich, people realize that that is special and they really welcome you.
Everyone that I talk to point to the camaraderie and sense of community and support that the club provides. They say it's a great way to make new friends or to safely explore new trails. I'm also told that it's a good feeder for town gossip, though they're all pretty discreet around the guest hiker holding a microphone. There's a kind of familiarity among them. And they're funny, like Carl and Jean, who do a kind of chummy stand-up routine when they stop to look over a map.
We're heading all the way to Josie's Bridge.
Don't give me this wee stuff. I'm turning around shortly.
This would be a very nice loop to go. Come in where we are now, go up the Bead Trail, and then come down.
On a cooler day.
Okay. And then you come out at Mead Base. So.
Well, your job is to go over there and talk to the beavers and clear out the trail. You're on the
there
conservation.
We're on the conservation. There we go, Tracy. We'll take care of that. Sure.
All joking aside, hiking can be serious business. And anybody who's heard stories of dramatic rescues and fatalities knows that hiking Mount Washington and the Whites is even more so. And while the B group steers clear of the most treacherous climbs, the A group some well into the 60-plus category, is still routinely bagging the biggest and the baddest peaks. So I asked, have there ever been any accidents?
I remember one where there was one hiker who was having problems. And it turned, you know, people just kind of surrounded him, took his pack, helped him walking along, tried to keep his spirits up.
That's Sue again. She wasn't yet part of the group when it suffered its one and only fatality. On July 19, 1983, Fritz Ransom, a 79-year-old retiree from Texas, dropped dead halfway through a 17-mile hike. Another member, Jean Common, who said she had never hiked a day in her life until she turned 65, sat with Fritz's body while the others went to find help. There have been other scrapes and emergencies, a heart attack, an ulcer, but nothing else is tragic. Tracy Ripke says she hasn't seen more than a bloodied knee since she took over organizing the group. But still, as Jean Knox points out, age is a subject that cannot be ignored.
Given the fact that many of us, not all of us, but many of us are over the hill, whatever that means, there are various medical conditions, and most of us take medications of one sort or another. It's something to be very aware of.
That's one of the reasons the Over the Hill hikers eventually split into three groups. Rather than winding up injured, members tend to recalibrate as their bodies and their ambitions change over the years. The A's hit the Prezies, the B's do the 52 with the view, and the C's take shorter hikes and walks around the Sandwich area. Sue Spears has done it all.
Well, I was with the A's, I was with the B's, and now I'm part of the C's, only we didn't like being called C. We call ourselves the Turtles. And as we keep reminding people, remember who won the race. It was not the hare.
Sue is not the only one to tell me that the C group, the Turtles, are contemplative hikers. They stop to look at the view. They don't care about doing two mountains in one day. And best of all,
we always end with getting ice cream someplace on the way home.
Sounds like a pretty good way to live.
We actually looked.
Maps.
I wanted to read it first, but
I'm back on the trail. I'm starting to think about lunch. And because I'm not retired, I get a pang of worry about how late it will be when I finally get back to work. But somewhere along the trail, from Black Mountain Pond back to the bumpy dirt road where we're parked, that mysterious hiking thing happens. When you're there in the sun-dappled woods and you find a rhythm and time falls away, I stop interviewing folks about the group and start talking about things that you don't often get to when sitting face-to-face.
So much has changed even in my lifetime.
Yep. Well, I think change in one's lifetime, I think, has always happened. All of a sudden, you had the iPhone.
I learn about some secret hiking trails, legendary over-the-hillers who've passed on, and heard stories of late-life career shifts and hip replacements and heart stents. When we get back to Sandwich to say our goodbyes, I'm ready to grab a sandwich at the local cafe and hightail it back to the office.
Nice.
Could we
to
take
meet you.
A picture? Hi.
We tried, but it's glaring.
But instead, accept an invitation to sit down and eat lunch, followed by ice cream.
Exactly.
You gotta turn that thing off.
What's that?
I'd say we've earned it.
One of the things, actually, I've noticed about this group is there are not a lot of spouse couples who hike.
So getting away from the spouse is part of the motivation?
No.
The spouse left at home does not want to hear that, let me tell you. Even if we're 70.
And a little postscript to our story, Sue Spears is currently sitting the season out, as she'll be getting a new hip very soon. But her surgeon says that she should be able to get back out onto the trails next year. I did take a couple of pictures from her hike, and you can look at them along with the Over the Hill 52 with a View list. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. There are a number of mountain ranges here in New Hampshire, the Ossipees and Belknaps, the Sandwich Range, and of course, the Whites. But one set of peaks is set apart from the others and doesn't often wind up on those must-climb mountain lists, which doesn't mean it isn't cherished. This next story, produced by Taylor Quimby, is part of our Only in New Hampshire series, where we set out to answer your questions about the state.
The woman that got us started on this story is named Jen. So, to start, I called her up, and I asked her one of the stupidest questions I've ever asked. Jen, how do I say your last name just so I don't mess it up?
Smith.
Okay. All right. So, no, yeah,
all right. It's the easiest name. Yeah. It's like John Doe, but it's Jen Smith.
Here's what Jen wanted to know.
Can you tell me what the geographic origins of the Wapak Range are? Does that work? You want me to say it again?
No, that was perfect. The Wapak Range runs north to south, a 20-mile stretch that crosses several peaks into the Massachusetts border. Pac-Monadnock, Temple, Kidder, Pratt Mountain, and a few others. They're not big mountains, but Jen says it's a great hike.
You're halfway in between Keene and Manchester, and it's really a worn, like an old worn trail. It's unbelievably beautiful.
So
you can tell. I would strongly recommend it. It's great.
Good. Now, I've gotten to be a pretty avid hiker these past few years, and honestly, I picked this question because I thought it would be an excuse to get out of the office. I could interview some folks on the trail, even write off the mileage. But first, I had to answer Jen's question. So I called this guy, Peter Thompson.
Well, I am a geologist. I have been most of my life.
Peter studied the geology of Mount Monadnock for his PhD, and he's mapped a lot of bedrock in Vermont and New Hampshire over the years. He told me that the Wapak Range is the product of a series of thrust faults.
During the compression, this is silly, but I'm using my hands. I had to put the phone under my ear so I could use my hands.
Peter described thrust faults as packages of rocks that were moving westward during a time when two continents were coming together. Thrust faults happen when one section of crust slips underneath another or over it, and it creates a sort of ridge.
Am I on the right track here?
Yes, but you might pull out your earth science textbook or grab a more recent one and just review what those terms.
Okay. Maybe you can hear it in Peter's voice, but I was in way over my head on this one. Geologic time is so vast, and the scale is so grand, that I literally had no idea what he was talking about. But I don't think I'm alone in that regard.
When I was mapping on Monadnock, hikers would ask me about the geology, and they'd ask, how old is Monadnock? And I'd always point out that my answer would be different depending on whether I was talking about when the sediments were deposited or when they turned to rock and got metamorphosed, or do you mean the shape of the mountain as we see it today?
Were those hikers always sort of disappointed that you couldn't provide a simple answer?
Well, yeah, but I'm a teacher, so yeah. You know, the role of teaching is to get people to think a little deeper.
I talked with Peter for 40 minutes, and I asked him a lot more stupid questions before the end.
If we're talking about erosion sort of shaping the landscape over millions of years, I mean, is the Earth slowly getting smaller?
No, it's in balance.
And after I went through my tape, I realized I only knew two things. One, the Wapak Range has something to do with thrust faults, and geology is very complicated.
Where are you headquartered?
In Concord, New Hampshire.
Oh, go over to the Geological Survey.
Okay.
They would be very helpful.
Okay.
And secretly, I thought geology is boring, like too boring for radio. Over the next few weeks, I tried to get interested by spending time looking at Wikipedia pages for thrust faults and igneous rock, but it didn't quite work. I was ready to scrap the story, but before I did, I decided to take Peter's advice and go visit New Hampshire State Geologist Rick Corman.
I mean, that's, the thing that's hardest to bridge in thinking about the Earth is the dimension of time.
Rick agreed that geology doesn't always translate well for the layman. There's the time factor. But the field is also rife with off-putting vocabulary.
Places with names like Gandaria and Avalon. I mean, it sounds like, you know, something from Middle Earth.
Yeah, I was going to say Lord of the Rings.
And Maguma. And so, you know, that's the language of the geologist.
This was the part of the conversation that gave me an idea. Because just like the Lord of the Rings movies are a streamlined version of the books, maybe I just needed to get a streamlined version of New Hampshire's geologic history. Maybe I just needed to go simpler.
So maybe if we sort of just lay out, what are some different forces that have created the topography of New Hampshire? Does that make sense?
I mean, so.
And to make it more like Hollywood, I'll add something that enhances any story. Action movie sound effects. Force number one, plate collision.
So you have compression, you have masses of ocean crust and continental crust being forced together.
When plates come together, they crunch the surface upward. This is what created parts of the Appalachian Mountains some 480 million years ago, when all the continents came together in one giant mass called Pangaea. But that plate crunching also forces crust down into the bowels of the Earth, where it's very, very hot. Which gets us to force number two, volcanic activity.
You end up with molten rocks that find their way to the surface. You get a lot of volcanoes along those margins.
And some of New Hampshire's topography is volcanic in origin. The volcanic ring at Pawtuckaway State Park and the Ossipee Range. But volcanic activity doesn't just happen when plates come together. Those plates also rift apart.
After Pangaea came together, it split apart again. So that rifting and extension of the crust allowed magma, which from deeper in the Earth and the Earth's mantle, to find its way up toward the surface.
That's force number three, which in our case happened some 220 million years ago. What's weird about volcanic activity is that, yeah, some of that magma makes its way to the surface, but a lot of it doesn't. It just pools in giant underground deposits. And those underground deposits are more likely to be what you see on the surface today. Which gets us to force number five, erosion.
You think of a mountain is something that is built up, but in reality, it can be something that is left over after everything else has been worn away.
And lastly, we have force number six, the glaciers.
And then, you know, the latest reshaping of everything was the Laurentide Ice Sheet.
All of New Hampshire's topography was shaped by a combination of these forces over a period of millions of years. Sections of the White Mountains were built during the collision. Other bits of rock were formed when the plates rifted apart. Some mountains, like Monadnock, were deposits of underground magma that weren't revealed until the rest of the landscape around it eroded away. And then later, the glaciers sculpted parts of our topography into what it looks like today. And the Wapak Range is all part of that weird, complex history. After I met with Rick, I realized that I had spent hours of my life just trying to get a middle school understanding of New Hampshire geology that I had apparently slept through as a kid. But I wasn't sure what level of detail Jen was looking for. I was sort of hoping she was like me, looking for a simple answer and a little overwhelmed when you get into the details. So I called her, and I discovered she has a degree in geography. She was looking for a real answer. So I went for it. There was an expert who sort of mapped Monadnock, and he told me that the Wapak is part of a series of thrust faults.
Okay.
Really, though, I just repeated the jargon that Peter Thompson gave me in the first place. And I waited for Jen to call me out on it.
That makes a ton of sense.
Okay. But I still feel like I'm not really totally sure, because every time I tried to nail down a specific answer, you know, the people that I spoke to would start talking about all these different cycles and things that are happening at different times and how complicated the sort of folding is when it comes to creating mountains.
Yeah. So actually, I think that's a pretty good description. Like, what it sounds like is at one point that there was a fault, and I'm not sure if I'm right, but a thrust fault being two plates side by side and one is thrust up in comparison to the other, right? So then you end up with basically a ridge.
Yeah.
And then you have all the erosive, forces. And that process of why those peaks are there, if the whole ridge was thrust up, it may be that there was erosion around those peaks, that they were a more resistant rock, the actual, you know, underlying structure of the mountains that are left, right?
Yeah.
After erosion.
Yeah, you totally get this more than I do. So that is basically our answer. Hundreds of millions of years ago, a bunch of sediment was smushed and turned into really hard, resistant rock. And as the eons passed, that rock was thrust up by tectonic plates. And when everything else eroded away, thanks to ancient rivers and ice ages and glaciers and blah, 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 the Wapak Range remained. They're like the roots of ancient mountains, ground down until only the toughest rock is left. That's my best answer. Although it took Jen to explain it to me. And I hope I didn't relay any incorrect information, but I'm sure they'll get in touch. If I say something wrong, they'll probably get in touch with me and I can let you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you can kind of rely on NHPR listeners to do that, I guess, right?
For Only in New Hampshire, I'm Taylor Quimby. And by the way, Peter Thompson emailed me after I finished this story. He told me that Wapak is actually pronounced Warpack. So there's that too.
Your questions answered, your state explored. You can be part of our program when you send us your questions about the state. Just go to the Olling in New Hampshire page at nhpr.org and fill out the form. We can't always guarantee an easy answer, but we will do our best to dig one up. When we come back, we'll talk about a pair of mountains you can't climb in New Hampshire, but you can find them on Netflix. The Strange Legacy of Twin Peaks, when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. After 25 years, Twin Peaks is back. Twin Peaks, The Return, is two-thirds of the way into an 18-episode run on Showtime. It is essentially the third season of the groundbreaking series that paved the way for The Sopranos, The X-Files, and The Wire. Filmmaker and Twin Peaks co-creator David Lynch is being honored at this year's Medal Day at the McDowell Colony in Peterborough. Accepting the award is Christine McKenna. She's an author who collaborated with David Lynch on a forthcoming memoir and biography called Room to Dream. I spoke with her before she made her way to the Granite State. So David Lynch won't be here on Medal Day, which is too bad, but you're accepting the award and speaking about him. Is this the first time you've played David Lynch?
Actually, yes. It's the first time I've played David Lynch, and I'm sure I'll do a terrible job because he's incredibly charming himself and very funny. I've interviewed people as part of festivals that he's organized, but I've never spoken on behalf of David.
So I guess he's a shy man, not prone to doing interviews. And you've been writing a book with him. I'm curious what that process has been like.
It's been really fun. David is very fun to work with because he's funny, and he's given me a lot of leeway. I've interviewed about 110 people for the book, and it's an unusual book the way it's structured. I will write a chapter based on interviews and research and then say on his childhood. Then he reads the chapter and he does a chapter in response to that. And when he goes through my chapters, he has the option of taking things out he doesn't want in there, and he corrects mistakes, of course, but he's taken very little out. He's kind of letting the people in his life have their say about their relationship with him without really interfering.
Well, I'm really interested to hear about his creative process, and especially we will get to the return of Twin Peaks, but let's go to the original. I mean, because there was really nothing like that up on television up until that time. It was the top-rated series of 1990. Amazing to think of it on network television. Why did ABC even take a chance on Twin Peaks?
I think ABC took a chance on Twin Peaks because it was the perfect convergence of elements. There was an adventurous programmer there, Brandon Tartikoff, at the time, who they originally pitched it to. And David was working with Mark Frost, who was a kind of a veteran of television writing. He was a staff writer on Hill Street Blues for several years. So Mark kind of knew the rules of television and was able to present David in a less challenging way to television executives. Basically, Mark kind of built a container for David's art that ABC could relate to.
What was the challenge in working with David Lynch on a television series?
David loves abstractions. He doesn't really concern himself with linear narratives, and because life doesn't really unfold like a linear narrative. There's memories and fantasies and desires flickering through our heads all day long. And that's kind of the way he creates his art. And so the challenge, I guess, for Mark, I don't really want to speak for Mark, but was to manicure David's visions to the degree that viewers, your average viewer, could latch onto them somehow. And so Mark imposed, I think, a little more structure on David's work. And that's pretty much the most important thing he brought to it, I think.
Well, let's hear just a little bit from the original Twin Peaks series. I mean, if you haven't seen the series, it's just weird. And if you have seen the series, you know what I'm talking about. In this scene, Kyle MacLachlan, he plays Agent Cooper. He's an FBI agent sent to this small town, northwestern town of Twin Peaks, to investigate the murder of the homecoming queen, Laura Palmer. So he's sitting at the roadhouse watching this kind of jaunty music, and all of a sudden the scene changes, and out comes a giant.
It is happening again. It is happening again.
That's a scene from the original series Twin Peaks, the first season. Kyle MacLachlan, Agent Cooper, is watching music, and suddenly the scene changes and the music changes and a giant appears. Christine McKenna, people say the world was not ready for Twin Peaks, but how did it influence television that came after it?
Well, it was clearly ready for Twin Peaks because everybody loved the show internationally. I think it just broadened everything. It took down a lot of walls in terms of just doing away with the conventional structure of episodic television. David didn't want closed endings on the show. Conventionally, television episodes had a closed ending, so it would be wrapped up and anybody could just drop in and watch any episode without having to follow the whole show. David didn't want that. He wanted open endings and he wanted mystery to be floating through the whole thing. He didn't want mysteries resolved. He kind of wanted to just multiply them, which he did.
Well, we know we pick up some of these, like the use of music, the use of effective score, of even the credits, of the sense of the paranormal, these sequences that seem like they could be dreams or not in The Sopranos and The X-Files and The Wire. Do you think it's fair to say that he was a progenitor of this prestige television era we're living in now?
Oh, absolutely, because Twin Peaks, they pitched it in 89 and started, they wrote and shot it in 89, which was before anything else on television, before television started becoming the new art house, which is pretty much what it is now. So David and Mark definitely did the groundwork on that.
I'm refreshing myself on Twin Peaks, the original series, because it was so long ago that we watched it. And at that time, you know, people were wondering, is he kidding or not? Is he messing with us? I mean, all of these crazy plot twists and loopy storylines, was he just messing with us?
Oh, David was absolutely not messing with anybody. He loves these characters and he loves these stories and he respects these characters. I knew I was going to speak to you today, so last night I watched the first two episodes and they were fabulous. They were so funny and the performances are amazing and the production design is incredible. The reason that show was so important is because it was really great, even if it, you know, adding unusual on top of it and groundbreaking, but it was just beautifully done, and Kyle MacLachlan's just amazing in it. Agent Cooper is a wonderful creation, and David definitely was not messing people with these creations.
Did the actors know what was going on?
David doesn't really like his actors to know what's going on because it creates a certain climate on the set of openness and possibility. For instance, with the new Twin Peaks, David's gotten even more that way. Nobody who performed in the new series, The Return, read the whole script. They got their pages just the day that they were going to perform. They got their pages of their scene, but they didn't know anything about what was going on around them. He had a screening on, when was it, May 19th? He screened the Return, the first episode for the cast and crew, and people were surprised. They really did not know what the piece was going to be.
So here's a clip from episode 8 of Twin Peaks, The Return. Kyle MacLachlan and so many other characters from the original series are back as Agent Cooper here getting shot.
Looks like you're out half a million.
Well, I think you're wrong about that. Tricked you.
What's interesting here is that this is the era of, unlike the original Twin Peaks, people could binge-watch. David Lynch is releasing this in episodes. Is he against the binge-watching phenomenon?
I know that David binge-watches things sometimes, but he didn't want The Return to be experienced that way. He wanted people to be more involved, and every episode is so dense, really, with content that if you binge-watched it, it would be like having 18 slices of chocolate cake in a row. They're just too rich, particularly that episode that you just played a clip from. Episode 8 is just staggering. It's so original and wonderful, and that's one piece in the series that really is a standalone film. So anybody who hasn't seen it, if you haven't watched any of it, definitely watch episode 8.
David Lynch did make a prequel in 1992, a feature, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. So what makes him come back to Twin Peaks over in that series and all these years later, 25 years later?
Well, he said he just loves that world. And having worked on this biography of him, I now know it's kind of the world of his childhood in the 50s. It's America in the 50s, where there's still an innocence to the world, but there's very sinister things going on, too. And I think he returns to this world the same way all of us return to our childhood memories. The difference is he can make a movie of it.
How does he like making television?
He likes making television, I think, because he likes the idea of a story that never ends. Hmm. And he can just, I mean, this story could go on forever, I'm sure, in David's mind. And I think that's the main thing he likes about it.
I think so many people think of David Lynch films and as a filmmaker and kind of scratch their head and sometimes wonder what he's getting at. Is there something, some perspective or insight into David Lynch that you'd like us to know?
Well, in 1973, David started meditating. He started doing transcendental meditation, and that is a really key part of his worldview and how he experiences life. He's identified himself as a Hindu, and a lot of the beliefs of the ancient Vedas are very central to his life. And when you know that about him, and if you know something about Vedanta and Hindu thought, you can see that in his work. It really is kind of an organizing principle in there. So that I think, is a key part of understanding what he's doing.
Well, let listeners know that Twin Peaks, The Return, comes to the end of its run on Showtime with an all-day marathon, followed by the two-hour finale. That's on September 3rd. But Christine McKenna, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Certainly.
Christine McKenna, author of I Scare Myself, Notes from a Revolution, and other books, and co-author with David Lynch of his forthcoming memoir and biography. Some special thanks for this episode goes to Tracy Ripke and to Sue Spears. Next Sunday, we're putting together a show that's going to take place, in part, on New Hampshire's college campuses. College is a place where students can find community or feel like outsiders. So we'd like to know, where and when in your life have you felt out of place?
I've always felt out of place at gyms and gym-related spaces like locker rooms.
And it was mostly middle-aged single men.
Whenever I'm in a situation where there's a large group of people and then someone decides to say grace.
You can share your own story about feeling like the other or out of place by sending a tweet at Word of Mouth. And tune into next Sunday's show to hear more. Today's show was produced by Taylor Quimby with Logan Shannon, Molly Donahue, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Hannah McCarthy. Maureen McMurray is director of Building a Better Mousetrap. Music in this episode from Blue Dot Sessions, Puddington Bear, Ari De Niro, Dave Deppard, and Jazar. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us. Civics 101 is coming up right after the break.
Is the current Speaker of the House?
Don't even know.
Will they rule in the president's favor or will they send it to the Supreme Court?
You can't refer to a senator directly by their name.
Congressional redistricting.
Separation of power.
Executive orders.
The National Security Council.
Civics 101.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Civics 101, the podcast refresher course on some of the basics that you may have forgotten or slept through in school. We've received a number of questions and requests to cover the topics of grand juries. So Erin Corcoran is back with us to help us understand how they work and really what they are. She is a former Senate committee staffer and law professor. Erin, great to have you back.
Thanks, Virginia. It's great to be back.
Well, glad to have you here. So let's start with the basic, easy to understand definition. What is a grand jury? And let me clarify. There are federal grand juries. There are state grand juries. We're going to focus on federal for our purposes because there's so much there.
Okay, great. So a federal grand jury is different from what we would refer to as a regular or petite grand jury. So the juries you see on television are juries that are assigned to decide in a criminal case whether someone's guilty or innocent. Grand juries are very different. Their job is to assist the prosecutor in investigating a crime. And in the federal context, it would be a felony. So a grand jury is impaneled if a prosecutor decides that he wants to or she wants to further investigate a felony crime.
What does impaneled mean?
So it means that they're selected. And the selection process is similar to how a regular jury is selected. Their jury rules are called up. Jurors can be disqualified for cause reasons, just as a regular jury. But a grand jury usually sits for a given amount of time, and they can be assigned to actually be investigating several different cases during that time. So the prosecutors may have four or five cases that they're interested in having a grand jury investigate. And so they'll impanel this jury and they'll sit at the court for weeks. I mean, I don't know if you've heard of a friend getting called for grand jury, but they're basically out of commission for up like 6 weeks. And they're reviewing the various cases that the prosecutors have assembled into deciding whether or not there's going to be enough evidence to indict the person that's subject to the criminal investigation.
An investigative role, that's really interesting. Is that different than other juries in general who are deciding cases?
Right. So the only thing that the grand jury is deciding is whether or not the prosecution has produced enough evidence through witnesses or documents to demonstrate that there's probable cause that the criminal defendant that's being charged did in fact commit the crime, which is a lower standard than a regular jury has to convict for a crime. It's the same standard that a police officer would have to have in order to get a search warrant to search someone's property, probable cause.
Well, okay, so if they're investigating, this must be done under the radar, right? I mean, are they deliberating in secret?
Yes. So the right to a grand jury comes from the Constitution, the Fifth Amendment, which basically says any person who's going to be charged for a capital or other infamous crime is entitled to a grand jury. And so while the grand jury definitely has that investigative function, it also has a function of making sure the prosecution doesn't unduly go after someone without enough evidence. So it's almost a check on the prosecution as well as it is a tool for the prosecution to collect evidence and to sort of before they decide to go to trial.
How many people serve on a grand jury?
It can be anywhere from 16 to 23 members, and you need 12 to find probable cause. So unlike a criminal jury where you need unanimous members to actually convict, for a grand jury, you only need 12 to actually go forward with an indictment.
Do ordinary citizens get called to
yes.
a grand jury?
Yes, same jury pool as a regular jury pool.
If they're in an investigative role, I mean, what are the kind of responsibilities tasked with being on a grand jury? Do you have to be, I don't know, how do you get educated in the case?
Well, it's the role of the prosecutor. So what's interesting, you mentioned earlier, they're conducted in secret. And in fact, the only people that are allowed to be in the grand jury besides the jurors themselves are the attorneys for the government, the witness that's being questioned. If there's an interpreter that's needed, that interpreter can be there, and the court reporter will also be present. The records are sealed. The government attorney is not allowed to discuss who they're calling or the contents of what they testify to. And the grand jurors are not allowed to talk about the proceedings as well.
So no one's allowed to, if you're on a jury, you're not supposed to talk about the case, but you can't even say that you're on a grand jury?
You can say you're on a grand jury, you just can't say what the content of the case is about.
So what are then the limits of a grand jury?
I mean, the limits of the grand jury is they're not deciding the guilt or innocence of a person. They're just deciding whether or not the prosecution has met its burden in establishing that there's cause, probable cause, that this crime did occur by the person that the prosecutor thinks did it. But then once that happens, that indictment happens, then that prosecutor is responsible for taking that, having a trial, impaneling a regular jury, right, that will then decide the guilt or innocence, a different jury that will decide the guilt or innocence of the criminal defendant.
So this is their check in whether or not they can go forward on a case.
Yes.
So how are grand juries, I guess, used by prosecutors? I mean, in some ways vetting evidence. So would that evidence, you said it was sealed, but can it be used later in a trial?
Sure. The evidence that the prosecution uses can be used later in a trial as long as it's admissible. Again, the rules are a little bit relaxed for grand juries. One of the things to note is while the defendant can certainly be questioned by the prosecutor, his or her lawyer is not permitted to be in the room at the time.
Really? You can't have a lawyer in the room when you're testifying in front of a grand jury?
No. You can take a pause and step outside the courtroom and counsel with your lawyer on sort of what to say. There's also no judge in the room. It's just the prosecutor and whatever witnesses he or she decides to call or evidence. One of the other thing that the grand jury has gives the prosecutor the power to subpoena. So they can subpoena both witnesses and documents or both.
This is Civics 101, Word of Mouth podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. And today we're talking about grand juries with Aaron Corcoran. So what happens if the grand jury does not find probable cause?
So they can issue what's called a no bill, and then the prosecution, it doesn't mean that the case necessarily goes away. It just means the prosecution at that point in time cannot indict that individual for those charges. And so the prosecutor would then have to go out and find additional evidence or additional witnesses and reconvene another grand jury and go through the process all over again.
So because they are federal juries, would it have to be a federal prosecutor who would call a case like this?
Right. So they would be in federal district court.
Okay. So, of course, there are recent developments that Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller has been using a grand jury to assist in the investigation of possible ties between the Trump administration and Russia. What are the implications of using a grand jury for that?
Well, I think what it means is that Special Prosecutor Mueller believes that there's evidence out there that he cannot necessarily obtain with sort of his investigatory powers as a special prosecutor.
So, like what? What would that mean?
I mean, he may want to have access to emails that could be privileged or that he can't get turned over. He may want to talk to people that are part of the administration or people who knew people who were part of the administration who are unwilling to voluntarily speak with him. So having a grand jury gives him the power to issue subpoenas. If you don't answer the subpoena, you can be held in contempt of court or fined. So there's criminal consequences for not complying with a grand jury request to testify. In addition, prior to Robert Mueller, former FBI Director Comey was investigating possible ties as well. A big subject of the investigation was Mike Flynn, which there was a grand jury investigation that was put together. So the thought is that this investigation, given Robert Mueller's actions to date, suggests of course, this is reading the tea leaves, but suggests that the investigation might be beyond Mike Flynn, that there might be other people that could be implicated, or there's concern that there's other people that are implicated, which is why he wants to have this investigatory power.
So is there any kind of political cover in calling a grand jury for someone like Robert Mueller?
I mean, I think the biggest political cover is that it all takes place in secret. Right. And so that the press is not allowed to be there. The jurors are not allowed to speak with the press. The witnesses can speak to the press if they choose to. But other than the witnesses, no one is allowed to talk to the press or to talk to anyone about what happens, and the records are sealed.
I'm bringing up politics because there have been some accusations already that in locating the grand jury or grand juries, in Washington, D.C., for example, Newt Gingrich, I know Alan Dershowitz has also said, you know, this is a biased jury. Should there be any concern over politics in the calling for a grand jury?
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I think the jury pool in D.C., in my experience, is probably in some ways somewhat more sophisticated than potentially other jury pools just because of the number of people who are qualified to serve on the jury in Washington, D.C. Many are government employees and lawyers. I think, you know, sort of Robert Mueller has been, while he was a U.S. attorney in the state of Massachusetts, when he was the FBI director, he spent a lot of time in D.C. and in the D.C. court. So he has a comfort level with the courthouse, with the local rules. And the individuals who are there. So it may just be that that's just sort of a place that he feels more at home with because it's a place that he's practiced in regularly and as the most recent place that he practiced when he was in government.
So, Aaron, any takeaway for our listeners and fellow classmates of Civics 101 and grand juries?
Well, I mean, I think the other thing to think about, there's a lot of talk about how this is really political, but I think the other thing to remember is why we have a grand jury and why the Constitution requires it is also to protect citizens against unjust, zealous prosecutions. So it sort of serves two functions, and even the U.S. Attorney Manual recognizes that, right? That in one instance, we want to give prosecutors the ability to look at evidence and to talk to people they might not otherwise be able to do. But at the same time, we don't want there to be this sort of political nature to prosecution. And so we're going to use grand juries to protect against that as well.
Aaron Corcoran, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Aaron Corcoran, former law professor, currently a consultant. All right, class dismissed. Today's episode was produced by Logan Shannon with help from Taylor Quimby. Music from Broke for Free. Now, if you're looking to drill more deeply into your understanding of civics, sign up for our weekly extra credit newsletter. It really is a fast track to becoming a teacher's pet. You'll get supplementary reading lists for the topics we've covered, pop quizzes to see how much you've retained, and some tips on how to remain an engaged citizen delivered to your email box. There's a link to sign up at civics101podcast.org, and that's where you can send us your questions about the fundamentals of democracy. Chances are pretty good. We'll use it for a future episode. I'm Virginia Prescott. Civics 101 is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.